This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Last of the Tribe, The Epic Quest to Save a Lone Man in the Amazon by Monty Real. Read for you by Mark Bramhall. We need the tonic of wildness. At the same time that we are earnest to explore and learn all things, we require that all things be mysterious and unexplorable, that land and sea be indefinitely wild, unsurveyed, and unfathomed by us because unfathomable. Henry David Thoreau, Walden. Prologue. Behind a ragged green curtain of fern and palm fronds, a dry twig snapped unseen. It was an unnatural noise, a sharp note amid the softer sounds that hung in the air, the warble of ant birds, the leafy flutter of insect wings, a solitary man's respirations. He was squatting in a contemplative pose. His elbow was resting on his leg, his chin was propped on the bend of his wrist. But he jumped to an expectant crouch upon hearing the twig crack. Someone was approaching, trying to catch him by surprise. Through the leaves he saw figures dressed in colorful clothing. One of them whistled, trilling the note. The watcher slipped around the corner of his hut and ducked inside to grab his weapon. With bow in hand, he peered through a slit in the sloppy lattice of palm thatch that formed his wall. The approaching figures babbled in a foreign tongue. He notched an arrow into his bowstring. He extended the arrow's sharply fluted tip through the wall and took aim. The men outside spoke softly among themselves. He watched them, and they watched him. When the men noticed the arrowhead protruding from the hut, they lowered their voices. After several minutes, they approached slowly with their palms held upward. When he moved the arrow, they danced backward. They seemed to trust him as little as he trusted them. He stood frozen inside the hut, surrounded and outnumbered. Should he lay down his bow and step outside, preserving the prospect of peace? Or should he declare war? For 2 hours, he barely moved, paralyzed within the pause that separates drawing an arrow back and letting it go. Chapter 1. The Hut. It began with a rumor, a scrap of conversation picked up by a health worker delivering anti-malarial medicine in the scattered villages of southern Amazonia. In the middle of 1996, he stopped at a lumber yard in Brazil's Guapore River Valley, near the Bolivian border. Loggers there spoke of a wild man who roamed the surrounding rainforest, which they occasionally ventured into in search of mahogany trees. The man was a naked savage, they said, probably an Indian. But he didn't appear to be part of any tribe. From what they could see, he lived all alone in a tiny thatched hut with no apparent ties to another human soul. That's where their story dead-ended. The few who claimed to have caught a blurred glimpse of the man said he was as quick and crafty as a jaguar. Get near him, and he'd vanish into the forest's dappled shadows. Describing encounters with him apparently was like trying to remember an elusive dream. They were pretty sure it happened, but they couldn't quite grasp the details. It was a flimsy splinter of jungle lore, but it stuck with the health worker when he left the lumberyard and eventually made his way to the town of Vilhena, where Brazil's federal agency in charge of Indian affairs maintained a regional outpost. He previously had met the man who ran that office, Marcelo dos Santos, while delivering medicines to one of the region's indigenous reserves. If anyone could dismiss the rumor outright and label it a tall tale unworthy of a second thought, it was Marcelo. His job was to locate Indian tribes that remained isolated in the forest, completely cut off from the main current of Brazilian society, His small team of field agents was called the Guapore Contact Front, one of five regional exploratory teams within the Isolated Indians Division of Brazil's National Indian Foundation, known as FUNAI. The Isolated Indians Division was less than a decade old, created just before the country ratified a new constitution in 1988. The new national charter specified that if Indians lived on a patch of rainforest, that land was theirs. Not a single tree could be touched by an outsider. But a fundamental shortcoming threatened to completely undermine the document's intentions. No one knew how many tribes actually lived in Brazil's massive portion of the Amazon, or how much land they potentially could claim. So if a rancher stumbled across a previously uncontacted tribe in a part of the forest that he wanted to clear for grazing, the rancher had a natural incentive to chase the Indians off the property before the government could document their presence. The contact fronts were created to defuse the threat of clashes between settlers and tribes. Marcelo was 42 when he took the reins of the exploratory team in 1994 after 20 years as a field agent with FUNAI. One look at him, and it was clear he didn't really fit in with the clean-cut farmers who dominated Vilhena's social circles. He cut his hair only when he felt like it, and he'd kept the blonde beard that he grew in college, letting it go wherever it wanted, untrimmed. From his left earlobe dangled a loop of carved bark, a handmade earring common among members of the Nambiquara tribe he'd lived among for more than a decade. Give him a choice, and he just might walk down the street barefoot. Some of the farmers called him a hippie. A few turned the screws on the insult a little tighter. They called him a hippie who wanted to be an Indian. They weren't entirely wrong. Marcelo's right-hand man was Altair Algaier, a 23-year-old who had worked for Marcelo's predecessor. Altair had spent much of his life in or around the state of Rondônia's forests. He had a fourth-grade education and a mind like a thirsty sponge. If the truck broke down, Altair could fix it. If the team needed to build a permanent jungle encampment complete with shower and latrine, Altair could sketch the plans and build it. If they needed to be fed, he could track, shoot, and butcher a wild boar. He was lanky and lean, but as strong and durable as a pack mule. Marcelo rarely went on an expedition without him. Less than a year before, in September 1995, Marcelo and Altair had encountered two small Indian tribes that had never before been contacted peacefully by outsiders. The discoveries were hailed in the international press as the first of their kind in more than a decade in Brazil. For the Brazilian government, the experience had underscored the value of the contact fronts, and FUNAI was working to legally declare the newly demarcated territories as a single indigenous reserve. For Marcelo and Altair, the experience proved that the jungle, nearly 500 years after outsiders began exploring its depths, was still capable of hiding mysteries. So when the health worker arrived in Vilhena with the rumor about the spectral wild man believed to be an Indian, Marcelo paid close attention. The health worker passed along the name of a man at the lumber yard who might be able to tell him more. Marcelo and Altair decided to pay him a visit. All they had to lose was a day or two, enough time to drive there and back. Marcelo sat behind the wheel, steering the battered Toyota 4x4 across miles of dirt roads that were furrowed with wheel-deep ruts. Altair jostled beside him on the truck's unforgiving bench seat. The sun burned hot, and the wind rushing through the opened windows brought little relief, just dust and the throaty roar of the truck's engine. The noise was enough to turn a conversation into an exhausting shouting match, which is why they always traveled with a box full of cassette tapes and the stereo cranked up loud. The opening chords that blared from the dashboard speakers would have been instantly recognizable to almost any Brazilian. Jorge Ben's País Tropical. The title of the song means Tropical Country in Portuguese, and it was something like an unofficial national anthem for many Brazilians, especially those of Marcelo's generation who'd gotten hooked on a back-to-the-land credo that flowered in the late 1960s. Marcelo shouted, Jorge! As if calling out to an old friend. I live in a tropical country, blessed by God and beautiful by nature. But oh, what beauty! Nature had been uncommonly generous in this riverine corner of Brazil, painting the landscapes according to a maximalist aesthetic that placed little value on restraint. This was nature in the extreme, laid on thick, without apology. The flora was irrepressible, accommodated by a rainforest that had enough room for just about anything, giant hardwood trees, ropey lianas, trembling ferns, fluorescent lichens, heavy fruits on bending limbs. The animals provided an equally gaudy display if you had a keen enough eye to spot them behind a thousand shades of green, ocelots, toucans, tapirs, sloths, monkeys, peccaries, armadillos, caiman, and untold legions of insects that filled the forest with the hum of life. Scientists and environmental activists like to say that between one-third and one-half of the world's total species, plant, animal, and microbe, could be found in the Amazon rainforest. But that was just a guess, because it was impossible to catalog them all. But even if the claim couldn't be proved, the spirit behind it rang true. There was a profusion of vitality in this region, and it was more than enough to overwhelm the most ambitious taxonomist. Not everyone considered that a good thing. This part of Amazonia long ago had earned itself the nickname the Green Hell by those who likened it to a miasmal sump that didn't brim with life so much as fester with it. In the rainforest, the unremitting cycles of life and death are so tangled together that their differences quickly blur. By the time something dies, it has already started to become something else. The trunk of a dying tree is overtaken by fungi, and soon the tree becomes those fungi. The flesh of a peccary carcass instantly swarms with beetles, until beetles are all that's left. Individual distinctions grow nebulous, which can rattle the nerves of anyone who prefers a world defined by neatly ruled borders. The wilderness then becomes something that demands to be tamed and conquered, and civilization is separated from savagery. Marcelo and Altair rejected that view. When they sang along with Jorge Ben on the truck stereo, they were singing about the forest, a place that was neither paradise nor perdition, but one they penciled in closer to heaven than hell on their private maps of the world. This overgrown domain was their país tropical. But some of the landscape they drove through on the way to the lumberyard didn't fit the lyrics of the song. It wasn't tropical, and it wasn't beautiful. It was dead. For miles on all sides, an ashen graveyard of charred stumps plotted the void where the forest recently stood. The land had been clear-cut with tractors and chains, then burned. The horizon was no longer obscured by treetops, but instead was washed out by a dirty white haze. Smoke was rising from live fires at the forest's sizzled edge, a frontier that crept a little farther from the road each day. Every so often, the slender trunk of a denuded acuri palm, with its armor of fire-resistant bark, stood tall among the encrusted termite mounds that blistered the burned crust of the earth. Some of the fields were littered with disorderly piles of sawed trunks, ready to be stacked onto enormous flatbed trucks. Marcelo and Altair had been passing those trucks all day. They were the same ones that had chewed up the roads for dozens of miles in every direction. They regularly passed clusters of splintery gray shacks strewn along the roadside, fragile hovels that looked as if they'd collapse into kindling with one swift kick. The shacks housed the peasant laborers employed by the cattle ranches that were multiplying with bacterial efficiency throughout the region. Hondonia was still less than 20 years old, and in a single generation it had gone from a mostly unpopulated forest to the center of an agricultural explosion. As new roads began to fan throughout the region, this part of Amazonia was experiencing a rural migration that rivaled the conquest of the American West. Boom towns were popping up all over, little bursts of activity that invariably announced their presence with a roadside beer joint consisting of little more than a corrugated roof, a few plastic chairs, and an old pool table. Marcelo and Altair drove past such a bar when they approached the town of Chupinguea on the way to the mill. A year before, the town couldn't be found on any map. The state had declared it a new municipality just a few months prior. The locals called it the Bang Bang Town, one of several on the ragged fringe of Brazil's Wild West, and outsiders stopped at their own risk. Chupinguea's population was anyone's guess, probably at least a few hundred, but it swelled on weekend nights when the region's ranch hands hit the bars. Sunday mornings were a spectacle to behold. Walk through the barren central square just after dawn, and you literally had to step over dozens of bedless ranch hands spread-eagled in the dirt, exactly where they'd passed out the night before. Everyone who called this place lawless was guilty of a slight imprecision of language. When Hondonia was granted statehood in 1981, plenty of laws went on the books. It's just that the government lacked the resources to enforce them. That anything-goes atmosphere extended to the forest itself. Ranchers in the area had been known to fly over the trees in private planes, spraying 2,4,5 trichlorophenoxyacetic acid, the internationally banned defoliant in Agent Orange. Worse, empty plastic drums of the chemical had been scavenged by at least one of the local Indian tribes, which had been using the containers to store water, unaware that the small print on the barrels warned against reuse. Frontier justice being what it was, the deeds went unpunished. Marcelo and the other members of the contact front weren't cops, but when they witnessed illegal deforestation or other environmental crimes, they blew the whistle, calling federal prosecutors to complain. That didn't mean the police did anything about it. Hard evidence, such as earth movers and chainsaws registered to a specific owner, could easily be moved before police were able to reach the areas in question. Outright denials of responsibility by landowners were so common that Marcelo had begun to invite Vincent Corelli, a former FUNAI agent with a passion for documentary film, to accompany the contact front on expeditions and document evidence with his video camera. Those whistleblowing expeditions rankled a lot of ranchers and loggers. The contact front was quickly earning a reputation throughout Hondonia as an obstacle to progress. Even before Marcelo and Altair decided to drive to the lumberyard to investigate the rumor of the lone Indian, some of the region's ranchers were publicly accusing the contact front of putting the interests of a few Indians above the overall economic health of the region. When the contact front had discovered those two isolated Indian tribes just months before, the ranchers who had already laid claim to those tribal lands banded together in defiance, hired a lawyer, and resolved to fight the government's demarcation of 193 square miles of land as an indigenous reserve, off limits to development. Those ranchers had taken a clear stand. They had declared the contact front their enemy. On September 3, 1995, Marcelo and Altair had made first contact with an isolated group of Kanoa Indians. The tribe had been reduced to only 5 survivors. That peaceful encounter also had begun with a rumor. Before Marcelo and Altair had set out to find the Kanoa, Indian trackers believed that members of an isolated tribe lived in the area, but no one had seen them. Marcello suspected that if a tribe was living there, its continued survival might be jeopardized by the chainsaws that were eating deeper into that tract of forest with each passing week. Marcello and Altair, with Vincent Corelli and his video camera following in their footsteps, explored the forest near the banks of the Omeray River. Marcello walked in front, following a slender trail worn through the thick undergrowth. The trail appeared to be a natural inlet through the forest used by wild boar and other animals, but there was more to it than that. Some of the branches and stems flanking the path had been snapped in places that stood more than 4 feet off the ground. Few animals native to this forest stood that tall. More than likely, it meant that other humans had walked that trail before them. For 3 days, Marcello's team had been hiking, crossing streams and following trails that led them deeper into the middle of nowhere. But on that third morning, they reached an area that had been partially burned. The ground had been reduced to soft, white ash, and in the middle of that powdery residue, they found the fresh imprints of bare human feet. The team twisted their shoulders out of their heavy backpacks and ventured deeper into the bush, carrying only the essentials. Altair propped a .22-caliber Winchester rifle over his left shoulder. In his right hand, he held a machete, which he waved in front of him in lazy arcs, clearing vines and branches to untangle the overgrown trail. They inched through the forest with a measured vigilance, because making first contact with a tribe that is unaccustomed to visitors is risky business. Throughout Brazil's history, stories of first contacts were too often chronicles of violence and mayhem. In Rondônia in the early 1980s, the Uru-Uwawau Indians attacked an expedition from Funai with a fusillade of arrows, their barbed tips coated with poisonous curare. That was just one story of hundreds similar to it that loomed over the jungle's history like black clouds. But much of the violence wasn't started by the Indians. Wildcat miners in Rondônia, for example, had savagely beaten, robbed, and tortured Kitolu Nambiquara Indians to get access to the gold they believed could be found on the tribe's reservation. Stories about pistoleros hired to clear prospective ranches of Indians were common in every bang-bang town.
"Look at this."
Marcello stopped walking and inspected a tree. On its trunk he found one of the most common signs of Indian presence. Someone had stripped the bark and hacked a wedge in the hollowed trunk to extract honey from a beehive inside. He continued up the path, then froze in his tracks and held a finger up, a signal for the others behind him to be quiet. He leaned forward, bending at the waist, listening. The others began to approach him, but he quickly turned and motioned for them to stay put.
"Wait! Back up!"
Someone was up ahead on the trail. Tentatively, Marcello took a step forward, careful not to make too much noise in the leafy undergrowth. There were Indians ahead, camouflaged by the foliage, but he didn't know how many. Maybe just one or two, maybe an entire tribe of a dozen or more. Maybe they were calm, or maybe they were poised in defense, with arrows notched and drawn. This was the most critical point of any first contact, the fulcrum upon which success or tragedy often teetered. Since the 1970s, 120 Funai workers had been killed in the Amazon, many at the hands of Indian tribes. Somehow, Marcello needed to try to let these Indians know that his team was friendly.
"Hoo!"
Marcello hooted, a sublinguistic greeting meant to get the attention of whoever was lurking at the end of the trail, something to let them know that he knew they were there. No response. He whistled. About 50 feet ahead of them, two faces peered out from the leaves and palm fronds. A woman and a man stepped onto the path, padding toward the group. Both held bows and carried quivers of arrows.
"Amigo,"
Marcello called to them. The two Indians' faces were expressionless, but wide-eyed and alert. Marcelo waved his hand, motioning for them to come ahead. He smiled warmly, trying to convey an aura of peace. The female Indian said something to the man, and they stopped on the trail. Marcelo walked slowly toward them, and the male lifted his bow slightly. The gesture didn't seem threatening, just cautious. Marcelo and the others continued to proceed at a ceremonial pace. The Indians observed them with tense stoicism, then offered Marcelo exactly what he'd been seeking. Careful smiles. Marcelo's shoulders dropped, and he chuckled. The Indians held their hands out, palms up. Marcelo and Altair raised their hands in response and stepped forward. Each side of the encounter, the Indians and the members of the contact front, stood on the trail for a moment with their fingertips lightly entwined in a delicate, lingering handshake. Marcelo noticed that the hands of the male Indian, whose name they would learn was Pura, were shaking. He appeared to be in his early 20s. Pura's sister, Tiramantu, looked a couple of years older. Both wore short wooden pegs through their noses. In their earlobes and around their necks, they wore jewelry made from shells. 2-inch-thick bands fashioned from fibrous plants were tied around their upper arms. Large red feathers protruded from the tops of each of those bands, and a foot-long fringe of dried grass hung below. Each wore a 2-piece hat made from deerskin and palm fibers. One piece was a tight skull cap, the other a ring-shaped brim that fitted over it. They also wore shorts fashioned from scavenged salt bags that had been left for cattle on the pasturelands bordering their patch of forest. Though the Indians had never before had extended contact with the outside world, the design of their clothing suggested they had, at one time or another, experienced glancing contact with the rubber tappers, miners, or ranch hands who had been traipsing through parts of these forests for centuries. The two Indians took Marcelo and Altair by the hand and led them to their small village, deeper in the forest. The Indians fed them papayas and introduced them to the other 3 members of their tribe. Pura and Tiramantu talked in the shrill quarter tones of a sharp, chirpy language.
Batu, batu,
Tiramantu said, looking Marcelo in the eye before she broke up in enigmatic laughter. He smiled helplessly. He could speak the tribal language of the Nambiquara, a tribe native to the forests on the other side of the Guaporé Valley, but this language wasn't similar. He couldn't decipher a single word. About a month later, scholars studied their language and determined that they were part of the Kanoe, a tribe that most believed had disappeared completely from the region after clashes with rubber tappers in the 1940s. Vincent's footage of the encounter proved invaluable in contradicting local landowners who had insisted that the presence of an isolated tribe was nothing more than a fanciful myth, a romantic misconception standing in the way of agricultural development. The video prompted newspaper articles and television reports all over the world. Time magazine's piece was titled "An Amazon Discovery," and it quoted Sidney Pozuelo, Marcelo's boss in Brasilia, who explained that the Kanoe encounter was the first new discovery of an isolated tribe in Brazil in a decade. "We only make contact when the situation is dramatic," said Pozuelo, who explained that the Kanoe might have been completely extinguished by the advance of land developers if the contact front hadn't taken action. In the months following that initial encounter, the 5 Kanoe led Marcelo and Altair to another previously uncontacted tribe with a village about 4 miles through the jungle from theirs. That tribe was called the Akuntsu, and it had only 7 surviving members. They were completely naked, save for earrings, body paint from urucum berries, and armbands and anklets made of palm fibers. The Akuntsu and the Kanoe had been traditional enemies, but the pace of deforestation in the area had forced them to try to set aside their differences in the name of survival. In time, the explorers would learn that both of the tribes had been thinned out by pistolero raids. For decades, sweeping global forces had been converging upon the forest where they lived, ratcheting up local tensions to deadly extremes. The tribes had observed an undeclared truce in the face of a common enemy. Since the discovery of the Kanoe and the Akuntsu, Marcelo and Altair were finding that more of the wooden gates erected at the borders of the ranches were padlocked. Some of the ranchers had gone so far as to station guards armed with machine guns at the gates. The contact front had earned a reputation as a nuisance to avoid. But nothing blocked the dirt roads they followed around the ranch that sat at the entrance of the lumber mill. They drove over a rickety wooden bridge constructed with planks that were barely big enough for the Toyota's tires. One slip of the steering wheel, and they'd fall in the stream below. The lumberyard was buzzing when they arrived. A warehouse stood in the middle of the yard, and the afternoon sun streamed through the cracks in the wall's irregularly spaced slats. The workers inside wore heavy white aprons, stained with the same airborne grit that they carried home in their lungs and throats. Forklifts ferried 10-foot sections of peroba trunks, some of them measuring 5 feet in diameter, toward an enormous conveyor saw. Using a heavy iron hook, two of the employees would position the trunks on a wheeled gurney which fed the wood into the whirring blade of a large bandsaw. They sheared off the rounded edges of the trunk, squaring it down to its rosy heartwood, then slicing it into long, flat planks. The workers loaded the planks onto a lift and stacked them head high in the yard. Like most of the wood that was trucked out of Hondonia daily, those planks could have ended up just about anywhere, as chairs in a dining room in Sao Paulo, or as kitchen cabinets in New York, or as coffee tables in London. Across the road from that yard, Marcelo veered around the flatbed cargo trucks and found the building he'd been looking for, a collection of unfinished planks that had been nailed into a crude kitchen and commissary on the lumberyard's edge. Technically, the building was part of the logging mill, but the man inside wasn't officially employed by the ranch. His name was Gilson, and he'd been contracted to feed the loggers and ranch hands who worked its grounds. Essentially, Gilson was the company cook, and according to the health service worker who'd originally told Marcelo the story of the mysterious lone Indian, Gilson himself had seen the Indian's hut. Gilson looked to be about 30 years old, with a peninsular hairline and a thick black beard trimmed with precision. He offered his visitors a seat at a plywood table in the middle of the room, and he settled onto the stool across from them.
"So, how did you find out about this Indian hut?" Marcelo asked.
Gilson said that the lumberyard employed men who scouted the forest for new cutting grounds, and two of those scouts told him they'd encountered an Indian. They didn't get a clear view of him, but saw him flee when they approached. Behind a nearby tree, they found bamboo arrows on the ground. Those scouts got scared and left the area, afraid of being shot by a man who might still have been hiding nearby. But they returned the next day, and Gilson tagged along. Together, they found the small thatched hut that appeared big enough for just one person. Gilson told Marcelo and the others that he could show them the place if they wanted to see it. Marcelo told him that they most definitely did. They followed Gilson to the sharply defined border between farm and jungle and stepped into the bush. Over the next few days, they'd visit the site numerous times, searching for clues that might reveal who had built the hut and lived inside. About a third of a mile into the forest, they came to a tree that had a wedge-shaped hole cut out of its trunk, the same type of honey cut they'd found just before they'd encountered the Kanoe. On the ground, near the tree trunk, Marcelo found a bundled wig of sticky liana twine. He told the others that Indians often use that kind of twine as a sponge. They stuff it into the hole in the tree to absorb honey, then wring it out. A few meters from that tree, they ducked under some leafy branches and emerged into a clearing big enough for a single hut. It stood about 9 feet tall at the roof's peaked center, and it covered an area of about 7 square feet. The walls were made of bundled palm wood, and the hut was roofed with dry brown fronds. The leafy roof sloped down on all sides, forming eaves that ended within a couple of feet of the ground. From the looks of the hut, it might have been the nest of some enormous ground-dwelling bird. The camouflaging effect of the materials was uncanny. If they hadn't been looking for it, they might have walked right by. They ducked under the eaves and peered into a small opening in the wall before stepping inside. Gilson had been right. If more than one person had lived here, it would have been a tight fit. The dirt floor was littered with white ash from a small campfire in the corner. Judging from the coals, it hadn't burned in weeks. The strangest part of the hut was the rectangular hole in the center of the floor. It was about 3 feet long, 15 inches wide, and 5.5 feet deep. It wasn't big enough to sleep in and didn't appear to be used for storage. It was unlike anything they'd ever seen in the huts of any of the other tribes in the region. After that visit, Marcelo wasted no time preparing for a longer expedition. He believed that if the contact front didn't find the man soon, it was just a matter of time before someone else, maybe pistoleros hired by local land grabbers, got to him first. He had no way of knowing how far the hunt would take them, or how consuming the mystery of the man's existence would prove. All that the members of the Guapore contact front knew for sure was that the rumor was more than a baseless fairy tale. Whoever had built the hut had recently decamped, retreating deeper into the forest. They chose to follow.
Chapter 2. Going Native.
If Marcelo was destined to live in the forest, he was born in the wrong place. Villa Magdalena is a colorful art district that sticks out from much of the rest of Sao Paulo like a bright red boutonniere pinned to a drab suit. On the sidewalks, colorful galleries compete for attention with jazz bars. Marcelo's parents loved the bohemian vibe, and they raised a family in the middle of it. When Brazil's military plotted a coup in 1964 and established a 20-year dictatorship, his father began steeping Marcelo in the lexicon of civil disobedience. The senior Dos Santos was a painter and stage designer for the Municipal Theater Company, and he dabbled in socialist politics. It was a dangerous hobby at a time when South America was caught in a Cold War stranglehold of dictators, dirty wars, and desaparecidos. In the Dos Santos household, the military government was associated with repression, confinement, unthinking conformity, inflexibility, and brutality. Which is why it came as something of a shock when Marcelo took a government job in the summer of 1974. He stumbled into it. Regular camping trips with his father during his youth had instilled in Marcelo a love of nature, which led him to study biology in college. But when he contemplated how he might be able to put his degree to use, working as a pharmacist or lab rat, his mood blackened. One of his friends had recently moved to Porto Velho, a town 1,500 miles northwest of Sao Paulo, to take a job with INCRA, a federal agency in charge of demarcating land. He called Marcelo and told him that the trees were huge and the forests seemed endless. In other words, it was the kind of place Marcelo loved. Marcelo sold almost everything he owned, a rash act with which his dad, who'd taken to calling himself a communist, couldn't convincingly argue. A few days later, he was standing outside the bus station in Porto Velho. Situated on the Rio Madeira, the city had a backwater quality to it. Diversion centered around a string of outdoor bars that sat atop the steep riverbank. Brazilian pop music wafted over the water, where beer drinkers shielded their eyes from the sun's glare to watch jumping river dolphins arc out of the muddy river. Marcelo had figured he would ask around and someone would point him in the direction of his friend or the INCRA office. It wasn't that easy. He didn't have an address or a phone number, so he wandered the sun-baked streets, hoping to stumble across one or the other. He found Funai instead. The small office was empty and locked, but Marcelo was seduced by a notion of Indians that was based more on romance than reality. They shared all, hoarded nothing, led lives that rarely intersected with the bureaucracy of Brazil's military authority. The idea of working for the Fundação Nacional do Índio in one of its wilderness outposts captured his imagination. He set out to correct the geographical accident of his birth. He waited outside the office, but no one showed up. He learned that the local agency head, Apoena Mere, was at a camp near the town of Rio Pequeno, and Marcelo went there to find him. Apoena was a dark and wiry 25-year-old with bushy hair and a mustache, a man who'd already become a legend among Amazonian explorers. He was a second-generation sertanista, a uniquely Brazilian profession that's part jungle explorer, part ethnologist, part government civil servant. His father, Francisco Chico Merei, had led many of Brazil's expeditions to pacify Indians from the 1930s to the 1960s. Chico Merei followed a strategy of assimilation, the idea that Indian tribes should be folded into the rest of Brazilian society, not left isolated from it. He fought against the creation of Indian reserves, believing that encouraging Indian resistance to the inexorable march of progress would only create problems. Those views still ruled Brazil's official Indian policy the day Marcelo walked in Funai's door and met Chico's son. Apoena was raised among Xavante Indians to be an expert woodsman, and when he came of age, he picked up where his father left off, leading huge peacemaking expeditions into the bush. But like many others in his generation, Apoena was slowly veering away from his elders' strict opposition to protectionism and had begun advocating on behalf of the Indians' sovereignty and rights to land. But he was a walking contradiction, split by the duality that tore at the institutional heart of Funai. He was an Indian advocate whose direct involvement in Indian affairs often seemed to do more harm than good. His expeditions, launched under the banner of Indian protection, sometimes incited violent clashes, the jungle equivalent of gang brawls, with casualties on both sides. The Cultural Survival newsletter in 1980 tried to translate this grim incongruity into an explicit image. If all the Indians who died as a result of Apoena's peacemaking campaigns were laid out head to toe, the line of bodies would stretch for more than half a mile. Apoena offered Marcelo a job. He started out working for meals without salary. He'd type reports, mow the grass around the office, whatever Apoena asked him to do. But soon, one of the researchers at the camp suggested that Marcelo was selling himself short, that he should try to enroll in one of the classes Funai had begun offering to recruit a new generation of sertanistas. That new training program was the agency's latest attempt to try to clear an institutional reputation that had been ripped to shreds by corruption and incompetence. Funai was relatively new, having taken the place of a previous agency called the Indian Protection Service, which had collapsed in 1968 under a staggering record of institutional venality. A 5,115-page government inquiry had found that of the IPS's 700 employees, 134 were charged with crimes and another 38 had been hired fraudulently. Agents had massacred entire tribes, using everything from dynamite to poison. agency officials had abducted young girls to work as slaves. The former head of the agency was charged with 42 crimes. It's not only through the embezzlement of funds, but by the admission of sexual perversions, murders, and all other crimes listed in the penal code against Indians and their property, that one can see that the Indian Protection Service was for years a den of corruption and indiscriminate killings, Brazil's Attorney General Jader Figueiredo told a reporter at the time. Funai replaced the service shortly after the report, and the new institution wasted little time picking up right where the old one left off. In 1971, a doctor visiting the Paracanan Indian village in the northern Brazilian state of Pará found that 35 Indian women, and not coincidentally, two male Funai agents, were infected with venereal disease. A year later, a Funai agent told the press that the incident in the Paracanan village wasn't an isolated one. After he resigned, he said that the agency viewed Indians only as something to exploit in almost every way imaginable and cared not a bit about their survival. He lashed out at the government's ambitious plans to slash highways throughout Amazonia. The big development projects designed to boost the country's industrial sector were killing its natives. "I am tired of being a grave digger of the Indians," the agent said. "I do not intend to contribute to the enrichment of economic groups at the cost of the extinction of primitive cultures." Years later, Marcelo would realize that Funai's attempt at renewal by recruiting new Sertanistas was just another half-hearted attempt at plastering over deeply rooted problems with a public relations campaign. But in 1974, Marcelo was optimistic. He believed that if enough of the new agents were sincere, Funai might turn itself around. He looked into enrolling in the program and learned that he had to take a placement test to qualify. The test was in Sao Paulo. Soon he was knocking on his dad's door in Villa Magdalena, explaining that he'd come back to one of the largest cities on earth so he'd have the chance to live in the middle of nowhere. If anyone found bare human footprints in the forests of southern Rondônia in the late 1970s, they might have belonged to Marcelo. He'd walk for miles, his bare feet collecting scars as they tripped over the rough forest floor. Carrying a bow and arrow, he would scan the treetops for game to hunt, listening for the telltale hoot of the furry spider monkeys that could be seen swinging from branch to branch, one after another, in groups of three or four. The monkeys were safe. Marcelo's aim with a bow and arrow was nothing short of pathetic. For almost 12 years, from 1979 to 1990, Marcelo lived among the Nambiquara Indians. When he started, his job was to help organize a program that aimed to nurse the tribe back from the edge of extinction. He was hired to serve as a liaison between the Indians and federal agencies, including the National Health Institute, responsible for providing the tribe medicines required to fight the diseases they'd been exposed to from outsiders. As recently as the 1960s, the Nambiquara was considered one of the most primitive tribes in South America. Its members slept on the bare ground, wore no clothes, and used few tools. The French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss had spent almost a year with them in the 1930s, noting that the tribe's population had diminished to 500 from an estimated 10,000 when they were first discovered in 1907. In the Nambiquara's case, measles did much of the damage. An outbreak in 1946 hit them so hard that, according to legend, they couldn't bury the dead. Marcelo lived with a sub-band of the Nambiquara called the Negarote. The Negarote once numbered about 300, but had been reduced to a mere 18 members by 1979. Their territory was in a transition area between rainforest and savanna, and like the rest of the forest in Rondônia and in the neighboring state of Mato Grosso, it was shrinking. In the beginning, Marcelo lived with a small family in their hut, like a foreign adoptee. The Indian jewelry he wore in his ears and around his neck wouldn't fool anyone into believing that he was one of them, but the Indians loved Marcelo like one of their own. He quickly earned a reputation within Funai as a rebel, and he didn't seem to care if his apparent lack of institutional loyalty rubbed his bosses the wrong way. In letters to them, he'd slam the workers that the government sent to help the tribe in times of crisis, such as the employees of a health clinic who didn't live up to Marcelo's standards during one malarial outbreak in 1983. "They think of nothing but their paychecks," he wrote to Funai headquarters, "and don't give a damn about the Indians." Instead of identifying with his fellow bureaucrats, he preferred to align himself with the tribes. The romantic concepts that lured him into Funai didn't dissolve on contact with the Indians. They grew stronger. Instead of observing their culture at a diplomatic distance, he dove in and tried to emulate it, regardless of the fact that he wasn't fully prepared to do so. When they ate slimy insect larvae collected by placing buriti palms in the dirt for 40 days, he ate them too, then tried to ignore the swelling in his throat caused by an allergic reaction. For a full 2 years, he lived completely barefoot, until his feet got so sore and battered he was forced to abandon the idea if he wanted to keep up with the other men when they hunted. After that, he wore flip-flops. Throughout his years with the Negarote, his skin was pocked with bites. Ticks latched onto his ankles and burrowed into his hair, and he'd dig them out the best he could. He suffered through malarial shivers, but all of that was part of the deal he'd made when choosing this kind of life. "If you want to be one with nature," he discovered, "you have to let nature be one with you." Such zeal did wonders for his relationships with tribe members, but it came with a clear trade-off. The lifestyle, as many Sertanistas before him had discovered, significantly limited his romantic prospects. As a field agent, dating a tribe member would have been an inexcusable ethical breach, and it wasn't easy to find anyone else who could tolerate his far-flung, thatched-roof lifestyle. For many Funai field agents, the dating pool is restricted to social workers with a penchant for field work. In Marcelo's case, it was a nurse who specialized in treating the region's tribes. They eventually married during the years he worked with the Nambiquara, but the relationship ended in divorce, far from unusual among young field agents. His relationship with the tribes of the region proved more lasting. He tried to tell his friends and family that the Indians were simply happier than the people he'd grown up among in Sao Paulo. Marcelo believed their happiness was unsinkable. In circumstances that would have reduced most people to tears, he never saw the Indians fall into depression. Their lack of emphasis on material acquisition, their unhurried pace, their contentment with living in the present moment, in his eyes, all of it made their relatively simple life qualitatively better than the modern analogues. It was a whopper of a generalization, and it left Marcelo vulnerable to a dismissive charge. Marcelo had fallen for the myth of the noble savage, viewing their world as some sort of Edenic throwback, a paradise lost. The fact that the Negarote culture, idyllic or not, was disappearing before his eyes, defined his role in the tribe. He was an advocate, not a liaison. By the time he had moved in to live among them, the Indians had already experienced years of occasional contact with the outside world. They cooked their food over their fires in aluminum pans, and they hunted with shotguns. Marcelo sometimes drove them in his jeep to a nearby town to trade handmade arrows and necklaces for knives, axes, hoes, and shotgun shells. Traditionally, the tribe had been semi-nomadic, ranging over a wide territory to hunt game and follow the seasons of certain flowering fruits which bloomed in different pockets of forest at different times. But with the new tools and weapons, they didn't need to roam as widely. They were still a long way from being sedentary, but Marcelo could see that traditions were failing. He felt a little guilty. He tried to set an example by embracing many of the customs the tribesmen were abandoning. On hunts, while everyone else carried shotguns, Marcelo toted his bow and arrow. Instead of the ringing blast of a gun, he wanted to hear the quietly plucked note of a bowstring, the whispered hiss of the arrow, the sudden silence after contact. Of course, when he took aim at a bird in a tree, he'd almost always hear a less poetic sound, the twang of the arrow as it got stuck in a high branch. Another handmade arrow, which represented a full day of work, was lost in the unreachable heights of the forest. The Indians regarded him as a gullible dreamer, until one day during a long hunt they ran out of shotgun shells. As they walked back to their village, they saw a group of wild boars nosing among the leaves on the path ahead. They all looked to Marcelo and to his bow and arrows. He handed his bow to an Indian who was a far better shot. Within minutes, the hunters were trudging back to the village, hauling the heavy carcasses of two bristle-haired pigs. They feasted for days. It marked the beginning of something of a return to tradition for the tribe. Just months before, the Xavante tribe in Mato Grosso had clashed violently with loggers, and the government began taking away their guns, leaving them at the mercy of archery skills that had turned rusty as the tribe's integration into the modern world had become more complete. The Negarote heard of the Xavante's struggles and decided that maybe Marcelo was onto something. A return to bows and arrows might be wise. So for a year and a half, they voluntarily abandoned their firearms and started carving arrows again. The sound of arrows in the air was the sound of a victory for Marcelo. The traditional had won out over the modern. It was short-lived. By the early 1990s, pressure on the Negarote to sell timber on its lands to loggers had escalated to the edge of war. Logging companies were making deals with tribes throughout the region, trading food and guns for access to the mahogany that stood on their reserves. The Negarote, in part because of Marcelo's urging, refused. Another sub-band of Nambiquara, the Nambiquara do Campo, was recruited by loggers to pressure the Negarote to surrender its wood. Loggers and miners began hiring Indians from that tribe to serve as armed guides during incursions into Negarote territory. The idea of bows and arrows suddenly seemed quaint. The Negarote took up their guns. By 1991, two loggers and two miners had been killed during clashes, which helped spark an anti-Indian fever that swept through the towns of the Guaporé Valley. Attacks on the Indian villages became common. Death threats against non-Indians who defended the tribes, Funai agents such as Marcelo included, rose from whispers to shouts. Someone tried to burn down Funai's regional office in Vilhena. Marcelo was horrified. The happiness he'd sworn was an inseparable part of the Indians' lives seemed a naive memory. Within months, even legislators in the U.S. Congress were talking about how illegal logging and the international timber trade had made the prospect of large-scale violence frighteningly likely. During a hearing of the Foreign Affairs Committee, one witness described Marcelo as a Funai agent who has worked tirelessly to move the agency and local authorities to enforce the law. The witness added that Marcelo was forced to leave the state after years of increasingly menacing death threats. It was true. One day in 1992, federal police had to go into the Negarote village and rescue Marcelo from a firefight between Indians and loggers. He lay down flat in the back of a police car as they sped away from the village, fearing that if anyone associated with the loggers saw him, they'd open fire. He was shuttled to Vilhena, where the police put him on the first flight to Cuiaba, more than 400 miles away. It would be 3 years before he came back to Hondonia to take over leadership of the Guaporé contact front. And when he returned, he knew very well that even if traditional cultures have some powerful virtues, they're virtually powerless when facing the advance of a mechanized army of newcomers. When the modern world comes crashing in, very little survives the collision. In the middle of 1996, days after Gilson first showed them the mysterious hut on the edge of the logging camp, Marcelo and Altair began taking short hikes to look for signs of the Indian nearby. A narrow path led them to a second hut a little less than 2 miles